The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says she wants work to start by 2029 on some infrastructure projects intended to boost the UK's economy. She's been warned that pushing through a third runway at Heathrow will take Churchillian resolve. The Bishop of Liverpool has been asked by senior officials in his diocese to step aside over allegations of sexual misconduct, claims he denies. President Trump is planning to send tens of thousands of illegal immigrants to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. A vote in the German parliament is being seen as breaking a long-standing political taboo after it was passed with the backing of the far-right AfD party. Manchester City have scraped through to the next phase of the Champions League, and the BBC has been told the King was involved in the renaming of a submarine, criticised as being woke nonsense. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has told the BBC she wants to get the planning application for a third runway at Heathrow Airport signed off in this Parliament. She confirmed in a speech that the government would back the project alongside a series of other infrastructure schemes designed to kick-start economic growth. The plan for a third runway has generated fierce opposition from campaigners and politicians, including from within the Chancellor's own party. Ms. Reeves has also revived a scheme to realise the potential of the area between Cambridge and Oxford, which she says could be Europe's Silicon Valley. Our first report comes from our political correspondent, Helen Catt.
Further and faster. That was the phrase repeated numerous times by the Chancellor as she gave her much-trailed speech on growth to an audience at the technology firm Siemens in Oxfordshire. She promised that this government would finally deliver some of the potentially game-changing pieces of infrastructure, which have been stuck on the drawing board, in some cases, for decades. She said the country had strengths, but that its potential had been held back.
For too long, we have accepted low expectations and accepted decline. We no longer have to do that. We can do so much better. Low growth is not our destiny.
Ms. Reeves said that politicians had been barriers to growth rather than enablers. She suggested this government would be different and committed to backing a series of specific projects. Among them was the redevelopment of Manchester United's Old Trafford Stadium and the creation of an Oxford to Cambridge growth corridor to better link the two university cities and the technology and science businesses like Siemens which surround them. She also finally confirmed a much-anticipated announcement that the government would back expansion of the UK's largest airport.
I have always been clear that a third runway at Heathrow would unlock further growth, boost investment, increase exports, and make the UK more open and more connected. And now the case is stronger than ever.
The move was strongly welcomed by some business groups, but criticised by environmental campaigners and the Green Party. The Labour Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan, said he remained opposed to any expansion and could challenge any plans. It's an indicator of the problems that may still be to come. Some of these projects may have government support, but they do not yet have the permissions that will actually see them built. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, told Prime Minister's Questions that right now Labour's policies were damaging growth, and she claimed that many of the ideas in the speech were really her party's.
This morning, the Chancellor embraced a series of Conservative policies. Although many are welcomed, they will take years to deliver. Yeah. When, Mr. Speaker, when Conservatives left office, we had the fastest economic growth in the G7. But what is the government doing for growth now? It's destroying it.
The government hopes that giving its full-throated support to big infrastructure projects will inspire confidence among investors and in time will make the UK, in Ms. Reeves' words, the world's best-connected place to do business.
These residents of Datchet in Berkshire live close to Heathrow and gave their reaction to its possible expansion.
Well, I'm very much against the third runway. If you think of all the fumes that go into the atmosphere and everything around here, no, please, no.
It's got good bits and bad bits. Maybe there'd bring more jobs and things like that, but it would also bring more noise.
We do need to expand Heathrow. We're losing traffic to Schiphol and places like that. And we've got a lot of people who want to come here. I don't know why, but they do.
The projects backed by the government could unlock huge benefits for British companies. Our business editor Simon Jack has this analysis.
Heathrow is Europe's busiest airport. Nearly 500,000 planes take off or land there every year, carrying 80 million passengers and £200 billion worth of freight. And it can't take any more. Heathrow bosses have been lobbying for years for a third runway, and current chief executive Thomas Walby welcomed today's government backing.
This will take years. It will take what I call Churchillian resolve and lots of ingenuity, but we can trust a government that can be with us for many years to deliver this.
A new runway will cost tens of billions of pounds and take at least 10 years to build. But other projects are further advanced and could provide the timely and regional boost the Chancellor is looking for. Progress on rail links between Oxford and Cambridge, the two ends of a hoped-for European Silicon Valley, could start this year. And plans to redevelop the area around Old Trafford also got the Chancellor's endorsement. Business confidence took a beating at the budget last year, but today's raft of announcements went down well with Siobhan Haviland, Director General of the British Chambers of Commerce.
It's a really big signal to the market, to global investors, to UK PLC, that we're serious about these things. But it also means if you're possibly in that supply chain and you're waiting for that signal, that you can now begin to think about your investment plans.
Most of this will depend on private investment, but the Chancellor will hope that a sense of urgency and optimism can provide business spirit and the economy with a bit of a lift.
Friends of the Earth has described the Chancellor's speech as the kind of dangerously short-sighted thinking that has helped cause the climate crisis. Downing Street says any airport expansion must be in line with the UK's environmental and climate commitments. Our climate editor Justin Rowlett considers whether building new runways is compatible with the country's plan to reach net zero by 2050.
Aviation was responsible for around 8% of the UK's greenhouse gas emissions in 2023 and about 12% of the average person's carbon footprint. The government has said more efficient planes, sustainable fuels and other technological wizardry will drive down emissions. But even if these measures do deliver, and that's an open question, they'll only ever be part of the answer. One problem is that as the economy grows and incomes rise, people are likely to want to travel more. When the last Conservative government drew up its plan to get UK aviation to what it called jet zero, it reckoned passenger numbers would rise by half as much again by 2050. It assumed technological developments would reduce emissions by a third by then, but that pretty much just gets us back to where we are now in terms of emissions. So how to get rid of the rest? The Jet Zero strategy proposed offsetting, paying other people to avoid emissions, carbon capture and carbon pricing, getting airlines to pay to pollute. The problem? All those extra expenses would increase ticket prices for all of us.
In her speech, Rachel Reeves restated the economic growth was the government's number one priority. Our economics editor Faisal Islam has been examining when the UK can expect to feel the benefits of the various projects.
The bottom line is that the changes described by the Chancellor today, if enacted, will boost UK growth. It is an admittedly low bar for an economy that has not been expanding much. But this is a specific type of growth, long-term growth, funded by global investors who had started to have their doubts about Britain. So this is why the Chancellor is emphasising that visible fruits will be seen.
We're going to see spades in the ground, getting these projects delivered, creating jobs during the construction and then when they are up and running. That we want that to happen in this Parliament.
The one number that matters above all here is 156, the current size of the PM's majority. In the Chancellor's speech and in private discussions with investors, she had communicated that she would deploy this near total executive power to flatten the sort of opposition that has prevented or critically delayed these sorts of plans in the past. Outside her speech, farmers noisily protested about changes to inheritance tax announced in the budget. There will be many more groups with placards beeping their horns outside airports and building sites if this agenda is delivered. And businesses facing immediate tax rises may not feel the benefit of another runway in West London and laboratories in Oxford for many years to come. The question is whether the fruits of long-term growth will make up for the short-term pain being felt now.
Senior church leaders in Liverpool have called for their bishop to step aside while allegations of sexual assault and harassment against him are investigated. Bishop John Perumbulath denies the claims. Colleagues have signed a letter to the Archbishop of York saying his position is untenable. Ellie Price has more.
Bishop John Perumbulath is accused of sexually assaulting one woman and sexually harassing another, herself a bishop. The letter, signed with deep regret by six members of the senior leadership of the Diocese of Liverpool, states allegations made by the female bishop need to be fully and properly investigated. While that happens, they write, the Bishop of Liverpool must step aside from all ministry in the area. Bishop Perumbulath has consistently denied the allegations and has said he's complied with an earlier investigation by the church's national safeguarding team. The allegations of sexual assault were investigated by the police, who took no further action. The Church of England said the second complainant, who alleges sexual harassment, did not bring a complaint within a statutory one-year deadline. She later applied for permission to bring it after the deadline, which the Archbishop of York supported, but this was refused by an independent judge.
President Trump says he wants US security officials to expand a detention facility for illegal immigrants in the notorious Guantanamo Bay high-security prison in Cuba. He said it would hold what he described as the worst criminal illegal aliens threatening America. The Cuban president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, called the plan an act of brutality. Our correspondent Caroline Hawley reports now from Washington.
Guantanamo Bay is best known for its high-security prison that's been used since 9/11 to house foreign terrorism suspects. For decades, a separate facility has held small numbers of migrants caught at sea trying to enter the US, in conditions described by refugee groups as inhumane. Now Donald Trump has asked for that to be dramatically expanded.
We have 30,000 beds in Guantanamo to detain the worst criminal illegal aliens threatening the American people. Some of them are so bad we don't even trust the countries to hold them because we don't want them coming back, so we're going to send them out to Guantanamo.
The 30,000 beds don't yet exist, and the new Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth suggested to Fox News that some of the migrants could be housed on the naval base's golf course. Cuba has reacted with fury, calling the decision an act of brutality. The unexpected announcement came amid continuing confusion over a federal freeze on aid to millions of Americans. Faced with lawsuits, the White House said it had rescinded the memo authorizing the sweeping freeze. But President Trump has made clear he is still trying to cut and overhaul public spending in line with his agenda.
Britain's choice for the next ambassador to the United States, Lord Mandelson, says his comments 6 years ago about President Trump were ill-judged and wrong. The Labour peer called Mr. Trump a danger to the world and little short of a white nationalist. His posting in Washington is still to be signed off by the president. More from our political correspondent Ian Watson.
Lord Mandelson suggested he was egged on to make his less than flattering remarks by an Italian journalist on a podcast. That was in 2019, and if a week is a long time in politics, then 6 years is an absolute eon. Now only one potential barrier stands in the way of his becoming the next UK ambassador to Washington, and that is President Trump himself. Lord Mandelson has to present his credentials to the American head of state soon. While number 10 sources don't anticipate any problems, perhaps this was an opportune moment for the nominated ambassador to recant his previous opinions, and in an interview on one of Mr. Trump's favourite channels, Fox News.
I consider my remarks about President Trump as ill-judged and wrong. And I think that times and attitudes towards the president have changed since then.
Lord Mandelson had been criticised by one of President Trump's allies, Chris LeCivita, who described him as a moron. There have been reports too that some in the Trump transition team had questioned his links with China. But the Labour peer said that Mr. Trump was a nice and fair-minded person, and he hadn't heard anything from the White House which suggested there was a difficulty with his appointment. Leaving little to chance, the former Labour minister also praised President Trump's dynamism and courage.
The front-runner to be Germany's next leader has been accused of breaking the country's long-standing political consensus against cooperating with the far right. Friedrich Merz pushed through a motion in Parliament calling for tougher border rules, with votes from the Alternative for Germany party. Political rivals said he had smashed a taboo in the heat of the moment. The AfD said the so-called firewall was an anti-democratic cartel agreement. Here's our Berlin correspondent, Jessica Parker.
Friedrich Merz, who leads the Conservative CDU, is trying to seize the initiative on the fraught issue of immigration before next month's election. He'll hope his tough stance can take votes away from the far-right Alternative für Deutschland that's polling second behind his party. But critics say that by leaning on the AfD in Parliament, he's legitimising a movement, parts of which are classed by the authorities as extremist. This vote was on a non-binding call to tighten immigration rules. But on Friday, Mr. Merz is due to propose actual legislation. He says he neither sought nor wants the AfD's backing, but argues the measures are necessary. The Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, described his rival's actions as an unforgivable mistake. The AfD believes the so-called firewall that's traditionally blocked cooperation with the far right is undemocratic. So tonight, they're celebrating.
Israel says it's received a list from Hamas of the next 8 hostages due to be freed from Gaza. 5 are Thai nationals who were not part of the original ceasefire agreement. More than 100 Palestinian prisoners will be released from Israeli jails in return. Our correspondent Vera Davis reports from Jerusalem.
As the fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas continues to hold, the latest hostages due to be released include 29-year-old Arbel Yehud, who was abducted from kibbutz near Oz on October the 7th, and Agam Berger, a 20-year-old military observer. They're believed to be the last 2 female hostages still alive. An 80-year-old man, Gadi Moses, is also on the list to be handed over, as are 5 unnamed Thai nationals, agricultural workers who were abducted from the kibbutzes where they worked. In exchange for the Israeli hostages, 110 Palestinians are being released from Israeli jails. Their names have not been made public, but it's thought they include at least 30 women and children. While they will return to their homes in either occupied East Jerusalem or the occupied West Bank, Israeli media reports say that several others, those sentenced to life terms for more serious offences, will be exiled to Egypt or other neighbouring Arab countries.
The Palestinian Health Ministry says at least 10 people have died in an Israeli airstrike on the West Bank. The attack is said to have taken place in the area of Tubas in the north of the territory. The Israeli military said it had targeted armed militants. Its intensified operations in the West Bank since the ceasefire in Gaza came into effect 10 days ago. Relatives who lost 3 generations of their family in the Omagh bombing have spoken publicly for the first time at an inquiry into the atrocity. 29 people were killed in the attack in 1998, including Avril Monaghan, who was pregnant with twins. Her mother and 20-month-old daughter were also killed. Our Ireland correspondent Chris Page reports.
There's been more poignant testimony on the second day of public hearings in this inquiry. The 15th of August 1998 was Mary Grimes's 66th birthday. Mrs. Grimes's daughter and granddaughter, Avril and Maura Monaghan, went to Omagh to celebrate with her. On that Saturday afternoon, they were killed when a bomb exploded on the main shopping street. Eivín Monaghan was 5 years old when her mother, grandmother and sister were murdered. She spoke to the inquiry in a recorded video as a picture was displayed of an ultrasound scan of Mrs. Monaghan's unborn twins.
Our parents had discussed that they would be named Emer and Evelyn, 2 little girls who our family were extremely excited to meet and welcome into the Monaghan and Grimes family circle. Unfortunately, that day did not come, and the pictures of the scan are a reminder of the many futures that never became a reality.
Mrs. Grimes's son, Fergal, said the Omagh bombing had changed the family's lives forever. The inquiry is examining the attack carried out by the dissident Republican group the Real IRA, which was opposed to the peace process. It'll consider whether state authorities could have prevented the atrocity. But the first few weeks are focusing on the victims, with bereaved families giving accounts of their relatives' lives and their sense of loss.
Britain's biggest banking group, Lloyds, says it'll shut another 136 branches. The closures will affect Lloyds, Halifax and Bank of Scotland in towns and cities across the UK. The company said transactions at the affected sites had dropped by 48% on average over the past 5 years, as customers increasingly turned to online banking instead. Samples scooped up by a NASA spacecraft from an asteroid hurtling through space are revealing more about the origins of life on our planet. The asteroid, as wide as nearly 8 football pitches, was found to contain the building blocks of DNA in what scientists have described as an exciting outcome. Their findings were published in the journal Nature. Our science editor Rebecca Morell has more.
In labs around the world, scientists have been studying tiny black specks of dust from asteroid Bennu. They were collected by a NASA spacecraft, which travelled to the space rock and unfurled a robotic arm to grab a sample to bring back to Earth. The detailed analysis has found the asteroid contains thousands of organic compounds, including amino acids, which are the molecules that make up proteins, and nucleobases, the fundamental components of DNA. This doesn't mean Bennu ever had life on it, but the theory is that asteroids like it crashed into the Earth early in our history, delivering these vital ingredients that enabled life to start here. Professor Sarah Russell is from the Natural History Museum in London.
We really have this incredible richness of ingredients on asteroid Bennu, but probably on lots of other asteroids as well. And what we've learned from it is amazing. It's telling us about our own origins.
Scientists think if asteroids were bringing water and organic molecules to Earth, the same was happening on other planets too. This raises the question of whether Earth is unique, or if life started elsewhere in our solar system, but we just haven't found it yet.
Football and three English clubs are through to the last 16 of the Champions League. Celtic go into the playoffs for the last 16, as do Manchester City, but only just, as our football correspondent John Murray reports.
For an hour or so, what would have been the biggest shock of the night was on as the Champions League hole Manchester City were in got even deeper as they fell behind to Club Brugge. It was a must-win match for City to go through, and they dug deep to do just that with 3 second-half goals. Aston Villa took the last of the places in the March round of 16 with their 4-2 victory over Celtic, who find themselves in the same high-powered bracket of tomorrow's playoff draw as Manchester City, Real Madrid and Bayern Munich. And Liverpool and Arsenal finished where they started the evening, in first and third in the table, Arsenal winning in Spain 2-1 against Girona, while a much-changed Liverpool team dropped points for the first time in the group, losing 3-2 away to PSV.
The draw for the next matches takes place on Friday. The Man City midfielder Mateo Kovacic said he was just relieved to be in it.
Every team in the Champions League is a tough one. So first of all, we're happy that we are through now, because it was a tough group stage, let's say, for us. It was not easy. In the end, we are through. What's the most important, and then whoever comes will be difficult. So it doesn't matter.
Little has been given the go-ahead by the High Court in Northern Ireland to build its first ever in-store pub. The application for the pub in Dundonald in County Down had been challenged by a company that operates several off-licences. The judge said while the application was novel, there was no good reason for refusing it. Vodafone has carried out what it says is the UK's first satellite-enabled smartphone video call. It was made from a mountain in West Wales, an area that would normally be entirely off-grid. The company is aiming to add such satellite connectivity to its UK phone network by the end of the year. Our technology editor Zoe Kleinman has been finding out more.
On a blustery day in Ceredigion, a Vodafone engineer created a bit of phone history with this satellite video call to the company's chief executive, Margherita Della Valle.
Hello, Margherita. It's Rowan calling from a remote mountain region in Wales, in an area that's never before had mobile coverage.
Hello, Rowan. It's great.
This rural spot is not unusual in having no signal. According to the regulator Ofcom, 9% of the UK has so-called not spots, and many other areas are patchy. Vodafone hopes to create a system which could allow smartphones to switch seamlessly to satellite connectivity, as Ms. Della Valle explains.
We're opening the door to universal connectivity, to connecting people in the UK wherever they are, in the most remote areas, or whether you are even at sea.
there's still more testing to do, and a full service would require the launch of a lot more satellites. Vodafone hasn't yet worked out how much it would charge customers. Elon Musk's Starlink is working with T-Mobile in the US on a similar proposal, but has faced regulatory hurdles. Consultation is ongoing in the UK, but the industry is keen to end the not-spots.
And now for a look at the morning papers. Most of the front pages focus on the Chancellor's backing of a third runway at Heathrow Airport. The Guardian and the Daily Mail warn the proposals have not gone down well within Whitehall and among environmentalists, with their headlines suggesting the expansion plans have hit turbulence already. The Daily Telegraph makes a similar argument with its headline, "Heathrow will not be ready until 2050. The paper says Rachel Reeves' flagship plan to revive the economy will face decades of delays. According to The Times, assisted dying campaigners are willing to back down on the requirement for a High Court judge to make the final call on whether people should be allowed to end their lives. It notes the move follows warnings from senior judges that the courts do not have the capacity to take on the expected caseload. The Financial Times reports on an apparent gold shortage in the UK. The paper says $82 billion worth of gold is being held in New York due to traders' fears that Donald Trump could impose tariffs on bullion. The BBC has been told that the King was involved in the decision to change the name of a Royal Navy submarine from HMS Agincourt to HMS Achilles. Earlier this week, the former Defence Secretary, Grant Shapps, criticised the move as sacrilege and woke nonsense. But it has now emerged that the King was behind the decision, as our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale explains.
The name of the Royal Navy's seventh Astute-class submarine, now under construction, was supposed to have been settled in 2018. HMS Agincourt, celebrating the famous victory of Henry V's army over the French in 1415. But earlier this week, the Navy announced HMS Agincourt would now be known as HMS Achilles. Two former Conservative Defence Secretaries called that woke nonsense, suggesting the change had been made by the Ministry of Defence for fear of causing offence to a key ally, France. But it was, in fact, King Charles who'd intervened. Names for Royal Navy vessels are put forward by a committee and then signed off by the monarch. Queen Elizabeth approved HMS Agincourt to be the sixth Royal Navy vessel to bear that name. A son appears to have been less enthusiastic. Discussions to come up with an alternative started more than a year ago. One defence source suggested King Charles had initiated them. Both the Palace and the MOD have declined to comment on his involvement, though the Navy has already stated the name HMS Achilles had been approved by the King.
Returning to our top story, the Chancellor Rachel Reeves has made building a third runway at Heathrow Airport the centrepiece of her plan to grow the economy. She has also promised new transport links between Oxford and Cambridge, 9 new reservoirs, and the reopening of Doncaster Sheffield Airport. With his assessment, here's our political editor, Chris Mason.
Rachel Reeves's natural public demeanour isn't bouncy, but this was the speech which sought to spring the government beyond those jibes of it being a gloom fest. It was rich in content, some new, some revived, some turbocharged, and it oozed the language of positivity. The audience of business leaders listened in polite silence, save for mild applause at the beginning and the end. A stuttering, wheezy economy, chronically laggard, an equally persistent political cynicism, the backdrop the Chancellor confronts. But I detect now an outward determination from ministers to leverage their mountainous majority and the prospect of a full parliamentary term. If their gumption and stomach for it lasts, they have the numbers to pick fights and win them on airport expansion, house building, roads and rail. Given they describe getting economic growth as their defining mission, that long-running appetite for this argument is likely essential. Deliver it, or at least show signs of delivering it, and enough folk may just feel sufficiently better off to credit ministers with chivvying it along. If not, that majority will be vulnerable to shrivelling or vanishing,
as fast as it appeared.
Chris Mason, BBC News.
With Neil Nunes. We continue with Shadow War, China and the West in a few minutes here on Radio 4, after Stav Danaos is here with a weather update.
Hi there, good morning. The recent spell of stormy weather that we have seen has come to an end now, and high pressure will mostly take over for the rest of the weekend into the weekend, and this will bring mainly fine, dry and settled weather to our shores, very much needed as we still have numerous flood warnings in force. Now, a couple of weather fronts may spoil the dry weather at times, namely on Friday and around the middle part of the weekend, but essentially most places will be a lot drier than it has been of late. Under clear skies during the night, then mist and fog patches are likely to form. Now, Wednesday was mainly dry with plenty of sunshine as a ridge of high pressure started to build in. Glasgow was the sunniest place of the day with 7.6 hours worth. The top temperature of the day was further south at Blackpool in Lancashire with 10 Celsius here, that's 50 Fahrenheit. Now, most places were dry, but low pressure passing to the south of the UK brought some heavy rain to the Channel and to the Channel Islands. Guernsey saw the most of the day's rain with 31 millimetres recorded here. Now tonight, southern England will continue to see any cloud and rain pull away as that low pressure system continues to move southwards into France and Iberia. Now during the early hours, skies will start to clear with the chance of some frost and maybe some ice forming by dawn. Now northwest Scotland and Northern Ireland will see scattered showers continue through the night and these will fall as snow over the hills, especially so over the highlands with accumulations in places. Ice will also be a greater risk for some by the end of the night here. The rest of the country will see a cold and dry night with lengthy clear skies and some frost forming. Winds will be light, so a few fog patches may also develop. Temperatures tonight across the UK will fall between -2 and +4 Celsius. Now Thursday will start cold and frosty for some, particularly in rural spots, with a few fog patches and some ice to watch out for, especially for northern Scotland and Northern Ireland. However, there'll be plenty of sunshine across the country throughout the day thanks to a ridge of high pressure, with only a little bit of fair weather cloud building up during the afternoon. One or two light showers may develop close to Irish Sea coasts of both England and Wales, but most places will remain dry and sunny. It'll be chillier than of late, with temperatures ranging from 6 to 9 Celsius.
Stav Danaos there. China's communist government boasts that it does not interfere in the internal affairs of others, but it faces accusations of political interference in several Western countries. In this episode of Shadow War, China and the West, Gordon Carrera speaks to security chiefs about what's been going on.
Yes, sir. My name is Yan Xiang.
Remember Yan? We last heard him at the start of our series, a Tiananmen Square student leader escaping as part of Operation Yellowbird and finding his way to the United States.
Then I joined the army. I defended the freedom.
Yan became a US Army chaplain for 20 years, even serving in Iraq,